Story, survival, and the power of indigenous truths.
Part of what I'm trying to do with this book is to push back against the marginalization and erasure of my people and our ways of telling story and the truths that exist within our traditions, which, you know, through the writing of this book, I'm trying to show how they still get at so many of the truths of our world, our lives, and the world beyond that more broadly. I mean, you can't look out at the world right now and tell me that there aren't still tricksters and tricks, you know, deeply shaping current affairs.
We spend this Thanksgiving episode with one of the foremost indigenous voices of our time, author, filmmaker, and former powwow fancy dancer, Julian Brave Noisecat. His new book, We Survived the Night, is a groundbreaking blend of memoir, history, and oral tradition. This is Writer's Voice, compelling conversations with authors who challenge, inspire, and inform. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station, your favorite podcast app, or at writersvoice.net. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. In his new book, We Survived the Night, Julian Brave Noisecat regales the reader with the stories of his family, his people, and the trickster figure Coyote. He takes the reader deep into the legacy of colonialism and expropriation, the endurance of indigenous cultures of the Pacific Northwest, and what it means to carry both historical trauma and the strength of cultural traditions forward. The book weaves together myth, political history, family narrative, and environmental insight, all framed within 4 days of traditional fasting. Noisecat's storytelling defies categories, part investigative reporting, part personal reckoning, part vision quest. Stay with us for this powerful conversation now. Julian Brave Noisecat, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm glad to be on the show.
This was a wonderful book. It intertwines memoir, myth, and indigenous history. It's divided into 4 days of traditional fasting. Is this what people call a vision quest?
Yeah, that could be. That's one way that is described. In our language, we use the term etchem, which is sometimes translated as puberty training, but more broadly, it refers to your sort of spiritual preparedness for life, and then, you know, for potentially also a spiritual life. And the you know, the way that the text is divided by these interstitials that also, by the way, echo you know, the Genesis narrative kind of intentionally to put that in conversation, is also inviting a reading that, you know, what you're encountering in this book is partially spiritual, and perhaps also some of these events might be understood as having occurred in the spirit world, which is, you know, an indigenous approach to nonfiction, to storytelling.
It's spiritual, it's historical, it's very personal. The stories are woven throughout the book that are personal. There's family lore and Indian lore, coyote tales primarily. Tell us about the story tradition that you draw on, the people of Coyote.
Well, so firstly, you use the metaphor woven, which is exactly on point. You know, I think about the text itself as a woven narrative that combines different elements of nonfiction to put these different kinds of truths and storytelling in conversation with each other and to weave back together a sense of wholeness for myself, my identity, and the indigenous world that I've been, you know, reporting on and telling stories about that has, you know, been broken by a history of colonization. And I use the metaphor weaving very intentionally because for my people, especially my Xtatlinc side of my family, weaving is actually considered the highest art form. Like my great-great-grandmother and my great-grandmother were both basket weavers. And even though my dad is a noted Native artist who has work in the Smithsonian Institution, it's actually my great-grandmother and her mother who are the preeminent artists in our family line because their works are considered like our most prized possessions. So the text itself is sort of an homage to the traditions of the Salish people who really highly value weaving, which is also, I would say, add just a feminine craft, which I think is also notable. One of the major threads that I'm working with is a thread of nonfiction that has long been kind of denied as a source of nonfiction, and that is the Coyote Stories, the oral histories of my own people. Indigenous peoples all the way from Central America to Western Canada used to tell stories about the trickster coyote who was sent to the earth by the creator to set things in order, but who was a trickster. So while he did a lot of good in the creation of the world, he was often up to no good. And through stories about the coyote, I write about myself, my father, my grandfather, and how the trickster still gets at characters like us, and the ideas and metaphors running through his stories actually still are relevant to our understanding of the indigenous world today. And very interestingly, some of these stories also relate to really major moments of environmental and cultural history on this continent. For example, in the story of coyote stealing the salmon and then leading him upriver to our people, which he then used to marry into as many villages along the river as he could because he was a bit of a womanizer, coyote actually breaks a fish dam that in our Sequetmoc version of the story is situated near a place called Spence's Bridge, which is very interesting because experts will tell you that 11,000 years ago, there was an ice dam that held up a series of glacial lakes across the interior of what is now British Columbia, Canada, that really did break 11,000 years ago, forming the present course of the Fraser River, which was then populated by salmon. So in this oral tradition, we correctly pinpoint a major environmental historical event at the end of the last ice age that occurred thousands of years before the building of the pyramids, before the writing of the Bible. And I think my general point throughout the book is that this, you know, source of nonfiction, which our people always considered to be nonfiction, demands to be taken seriously as such.
Yes, and even then, speaking of the Fraser River, it was named after one of the Canadian explorers who went into that territory. And was it he who the people thought of as the return of coyote? There was another explorer at the same time, so I might be mixing them up.
Yeah, it was Fraser. I kind of love the story of Fraser's descent of the Fraser River. It is kind of a perfect encapsulation of, in my mind, of the truth of colonization. So Fraser is an interesting character for a number of reasons. Firstly, his family were loyalists to the British Crown. So they lived in what is now the United States and then had to depart after the American War of Independence. And his story kind of intertwines the two nations who are now obviously undergoing their own sort of contentious decoupling. But so Fraser kind of showed up in the West with a chip on his shoulder. He was a fur trader and partner in the Northwest Company, which was the competitor that has now been forgotten to the Hudson's Bay Company, which, you know, was the kind of preeminent fur trading power in North America. Fraser had a chip on his shoulder because he was the second Canadian to try to cross the continent north in Canada, what is now Canada. The first was a guy named Sir Alexander Mackenzie, who actually did it first before the Americans in 1793. He made the crossing of what is now Bella Coola. And then he was followed by, of course, Lewis and Clark, who get all the fame, but who made a probably less challenging crossing near what is now Portland, Oregon. Alexander Mackenzie crossed near what is now Bella Coola, British Columbia, which is still to this day, population of like 2,000 or so, like very, very rural mountainous terrain. So Fraser shows up on the river that is now named after him, the Fraser River, and declares to our ancestors that he's going to follow this river to the Pacific, which our people tell him is a pretty bad idea. Either the river, which is at the time roaring with the spring melt, is either going to get him, or the downriver natives are going to not take kindly to him showing up on the Salmon River and are going to potentially do him in. So we tried to convince him to borrow some horses and then take those horses a different route to a different river that would then eventually get him to the Columbia River, which is, of course, the river that Lewis and Clark took to the Pacific. But he thought he knew better. You know, what a story as old as colonization. And to sort of shock and awe us, he had one of his gunners at the back of one of his canoes shoot off the gun, which then promptly wounded the man who shot it off, in a sort of slapstick moment of colonial entrance. And because we were so nice, and also because, you know, we wanted a new powerful trading partner, the fur trade, you know, brought a lot of goods to our people. One of our chiefs, a guy named Klehusum, agreed to lead Fraser down the river to make sure that the villages, you know, that were next would not like shoot him on sight. So he went on horseback while Fraser made the very, you know, silly decision to try to toboggan down this river in a couple canoes. And long story short, you know, the memory of Fraser descending our territory was in some oral histories remembered as the return of Coyote, because of course what he did was very foolish and tricksterly like Coyote. He was also traveling down a river that Coyote himself was understood to have helped create and fill with salmon. And also because, you know, the return of Coyote was understood in our tradition to mark the beginning of the end of the world. And in a certain way, you know, Fraser's arrival did mark the beginning of the end of our world. And so Fraser proceeded that way downriver. By the time he reached, you know, present day Vancouver, which was a minor miracle in of itself, he had wrecked basically all of his canoes and had traded all the things that were of value to our people. And so he resorted to piracy. And this is all, by the way, based on, you know, his own journals. He writes about all this stuff in his own journals. And he steals a canoe from a chief downriver and then tries to use it to finish his mad paddle to the sea. He gets chased down the river by the chief and the Coast Salish, who then chase him back up the river in sort of like a, you know, Looney Tunes kind of style, like race. That's at least the way I imagine it, until he finally gives back the canoe and manages to survive to tell the tale. But of course, the descent of the Fraser River proved to be a failure in the eyes of his employer, the Northwest Company, which was trying to catch up to the Hudson's Bay Company, which had a better sort of supply chain for furs because they had Hudson's Bay to get their furs to market. And it turned out that Fraser's route was, as my people had told him, not a good route to get to the Pacific. And so it proved to be an uneconomical venture. And so in a certain way, you know, I think that the term Fraser River and all the things that are named after Simon Fraser are kind of a misnomer, in the sense that, you know, this is not a triumphal tale of discovery and exploration the way that it is usually told. It's actually a tale that is best and most accurately told from the indigenous perspective, which is as a coyote story, as a trickster tale. And so, you know, I gave a talk actually at Simon Fraser University last month. And I said in that talk, like, maybe we should rename the river the Coyote River.
And then the university could be Coyote.
Coyote University. In fact, I did sign some books that said, you know, with my signature and then Coyote University and the date below it.
That's great. So the book opens with the story of your father's birth, baby X. He was discovered in a garbage incinerator behind St. Joseph's Mission. How did uncovering that story shape your understanding of your family and yourself? And I want to say, this is kind of a setup to talking also about your father as Coyote, and then you as well.
Yeah, so my father was born on the night of August 16, 1959 at St. Joseph's Mission, which is the Indian residential school that my grandmother and family on that side was sent to unlearn our Indian ways. And the night watchman who'd found him described his cries for life as sounding like the noise of a cat to the local newspaper, which is, you know, stranger than coincidence, because, of course, our last name is Noise Cat, although it only became Noise Cat because the missionaries wrote it down wrong. It was actually traditionally pronounced Noisket. I did not know the story of my father's birth, nor did he, until I set out to write this book and to direct the documentary Sugarcane, which follows an investigation at St. Joseph's Mission. And I didn't know it because my own family didn't tell it. It was too painful. There was too much guilt and shame and trauma associated with it for my father, my grandmother, you know, so many other people. And it was not until the discovery of unmarked graves at a nearby Indian residential school, in fact, another one that my family was sent to, the Kamloops Residential School, until that silence started to break. And Indigenous peoples, including my own family across the continent, started to talk about this history of what the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in Canada describes as a cultural genocide. And so I, in the beginning of the book, depict the scene of my father's discovery in the trash incinerator at St. Joseph's Mission, which is, you know, among other things, a story of survival and survival of the night, which is also the title of the book, is, of course, We Survived the Night.
Say a little bit more about the impact. I mean, I know that many of us do know, since there have been a lot of stories in the news about, you know, the discoveries of graves at the mission schools, but talk a little bit about the impact on your family, although it's a huge topic, but the impact of your family of the mission schools, and maybe tell us one of those stories about it.
So it's sometimes hard to convey to people the gravity and the scale of this history. There was a conspiracy against an entire race of people. And I use the word conspiracy very pointedly because we are in an era of, you know, conspiracy theories, people talking about all kinds of crazy stuff, that global elites and lizards and aliens and all kinds of, you know, nonsense. And also a big theme of them is often cabals of pedophiles. But there truly was, in fact, a conspiracy against indigenous peoples in Canada, the United States, and around the world, an era that lasted for over a century, many generations, wherein indigenous peoples were not allowed to raise our own children in our own homes, in our own cultures, in our own communities. And this impacted multiple generations of my own family. So my father was born and discovered at an Indian residential school. His mother was a part of a generation that was taken away in the back of a cattle truck to that same residential school. Her parents were not allowed to raise any of their children. And in many other families, you know, in Canham Lake and some of the other communities that I come from, you could repeat that story back 3-4 generations. And what happens when that is done to a people is a few things. Firstly, these cycles of abandonment and abuse that begin with the schools continue, and in some instances to this day, children who were abandoned turn around and abandoned, like my father did with me and my little sister. People who were abused, unfortunately, sometimes turn around and themselves become abusers. There's well-documented social science about how intergenerational trauma even impacts our chromosomes. Our very DNA was shaped by this history and other histories of colonization. At the same time, this was actually, and I think this actually parallels in a certain way the broader public's understanding of this history. This was a history that was not talked about even within my own family. And I just want to give a real sense for the extent and depth of that silence and denial. It was actually something that in certain ways I was part of unknowingly. So when I was a teenager, when I was a kid, and I'd go back to Canham Lake to visit family, I heard stories about babies being born at St. Joseph's Mission, being put into the incinerator. And at the time, when I first heard those stories, I myself did not believe them because I thought they were too far-fetched. I assumed these were just ghost stories or res legends. And of course, I learned through the making of Sugarcane and writing of We Survived the Night that not only were those stories true, but that that story was actually part of my father's birth story. It was part of my own origin story, in a way.
You call yourself the son of Coyote, and your father a trickster in the vein of Coyote. How does this mythic lineage help you make sense of your father's absence and presence throughout your life? Because, yes, he did abandon you, but you ended up living with him when he was much, much older, and your love for him and connection with him is palpable throughout.
Yeah, I really love my dad. He's a very lovable, charismatic guy. It might be why he gets away with so much. you know, to write this book, I did make a pretty unusual decision for an, at the time, 28-year-old bachelor who had been living on the East Coast for a decade, and that was to move back in with my dad, who had left me and my mom when I was just 6 years old and who I hadn't lived with for the 22 years since, and who I'd, you know, for many years there, I only saw him like a couple times, if any, every year. He had given up full custody to me. And just to give you a sense for that history, you know, like I was then sleeping across the hallway from a guy who still owes me the money I loaned him to come to my own high school graduation. You know, like this was a real father-son story in the fullest sense of a father-son story. And while I was living with my dad, I had this notion, you know, he's an artist, so he'd be out in the garage carving, which, by the way, is a lot more fun sort of artistic practice than writing. Like while I'm hunched over a laptop, like he's out there jamming out to Led Zeppelin, you know, adzing at a log, taking rips from the bong. Like it looks like a music video when he makes art. Like I, on the other hand, look like someone who's headed towards horrible posture and a permanent writer's back, even though I'm only in my 30s. And you can't talk to me when I'm writing. Like, you know, it just ruins the whole flow for me. So while I was writing, I had this notion, and it was very small at the time, that I would ornament the text with, you know, little pieces of my own people's oral history. And these were not oral histories that I had heard, really, because the residential schools had done their job. They had nearly wiped my culture off the face of this earth. I had actually only heard one uncle ever tell a coyote story in my entire life. And it was like one of my grandfather's many stray kids is kind of the way that I would put that. My grandfather had 19 kids and some of them, you know, were on different reses with different women. And we didn't meet them until they were, you know, this uncle I didn't meet until he was in his 50s and he's gone now. And so that is really the existence of the coyote stories, at least within my own family and my own culture. This is a tradition that is on the brink of being forgotten. And so I was reading, because I really was, I did have to read them to learn them, coyote stories in 100-year-plus-old anthropological texts, you know, like on JSTOR and that kind of a thing. And one day I was just reading, you know, some of the stories from my own people about our trickster forefather, this epic creator and sometimes destroyer, this survivor, abandoning father. And then I was looking across the hallway at my father, this epic creator and destroyer, you know, this survivor, abandoning father. And it just kind of clicked for me. I went, oh my God, you know, like my father is Coyote, you know, the trickster who we've always considered our ancestor, you know, lives on through him and through my grandfather and probably through me. And you can imagine, you know, on and on through men in my family line. And I think that that language of the trickster, you know, this figure who is at once, you know, an honored, epic first ancestor and who is also, you know, mischievous and up to no good. And while he does good things, he's also sometimes self-serving, gave me a way, a language really, to understand my own father and his ways and also his survival. Because the probably most significant detail in Coyote is that he never dies. He might actually die in the story, but like the understanding is that he always resurrects and rides again for yet another trick. And I think that that language gave me a way to both honor my father as the way I see him, this epic ancestor in my line, and also simultaneously to be honest about him and the way that he has been a complicated figure for me and my sister. And it also gives me a way to talk about myself and my grandfather and other men, people who I love, in a way that is also kind of honest and truthful about our ways.
The coyote tradition goes far back. I mean, you talk about your grandfather, your pa'a. You talk about him and I think probably even possibly his father, your father, and you in the same tradition. Coyote's almost a Christ-like figure. He dies and he's resurrected. Not Christ-like maybe in the trickster part of it, but certainly in a deeper meaning about survival. And of course, the title of your book, Julian Brave, Noise Cat, is We Survive the Night. How do you intertwine the various qualities of Coyote with this light and this dark, the positive and the negative, the creator and the destroyer, even in your own sense of yourself?
Well, firstly, I just want to say that I think that Coyote as a figure is quite literary. You know, part of what I'm trying to do with this book is to push back against the marginalization and erasure of my people and our ways of telling story and the truths that exist within our traditions, which, you know, through the writing of this book, I'm trying to show how they still get at so many of the truths of our world, our lives, and the world beyond that more broadly. I mean, you can't look out at the world right now and tell me that there aren't still tricksters and tricks, deeply shaping current affairs. And so that was really important to me to make that point, because, the Coyote stories are an enormous body of oral literature that have never really been taken seriously by the humanities. I went to a university that taught the great books of Western civilization, named after the poetic form of Columbus. So I'll let you guess what university it was. And, we had to read the Iliad and the Odyssey and Virginia Woolf and many different texts in between those. And, could they have not put like a 5-page Coyote Steals the Salmon on there? Like, I think that it deserves its place in the traditions of great traditions around the world. And I think that part of what's so powerful about the Coyote is that, he is both this lovable, mischievous, charismatic character who carries thousands of years worth of stories and ancestry and the creation of the world through these stories that are, by the way, very entertaining and therefore memorable, which is an essential part of any tradition, is being memorable. And that is why Coyote is so funny, slapstick, entertaining. It made it so that you would not forget the stories about him, because if your tradition depended on your people remembering who they are, the story's got to be memorable. Otherwise, it's just a lecture and your ways would be at risk of being forgotten. And I think also the stories actually get at a lot of the ways that our people are, as any great, storytelling does. And that is true for, my father and his survival. That is true of my grandfather and his womanizing. I mentioned he had 19 kids. I kind of joke in the book that he nearly single-handedly brought our people back from a genocide, which is, demographically speaking, not like that far from the truth. It is a bit hyperbolic, but it's not completely untrue. And then I do write about, myself, because what is interesting to me about my relationship to my father and, the men in my line is that I also kind of regarded them in a certain way like Coyote, even though I didn't know that at the time. They were examples to me of how not to be, which is exactly what the Coyote stories were for our children, for countless generations going back. And yet, as I look back on, myself as a young man, I'm in my 30s now, there are certain ways in which I unwittingly was following in the footsteps of my, my Coyote father and his Coyote father. I similarly have been a bit of a wanderer. I'm right now living a nomadic life out of a hotel to make a living. And, I went as far away from the West Coast as I could get to go to school and to make a career, first New York, and then even further than that to the United Kingdom, to Oxford, which is probably like the most imperial educational institution you could possibly imagine. I, thought that I would never become an alcoholic. And then yet in my 20s, I had my own struggles with alcoholism that, were frankly dangerous to myself, to people around me. And made me into a person who I, in retrospect, really did not want to be. And then, I read about this in the book, and this is a hard one to do justice in this kind of a format. But, I've also had my own struggles with women. My grandfather was a textbook womanizer. And, in the book, I write a bit about my infidelities and the way that in certain ways I was echoing Coyote behaviors that, my grandfather definitely has had struggled with, that my uncles struggled with. My dad actually less so on that regard, although he has had now 3-ish marriages. So, you could make the case the other way, I guess. And, I also think that it's a way for me to be in the book. I'm so sometimes brutally raw and honest about the truth of this history and my family and my father and my grandfather, that it also only feels fair for me to be honest about myself. And that is part of my truth. I have been Coyote more than I would like to admit.
Stay tuned for more of our conversation with Julian Brave Noisecat after the break. And don't forget to sign up for the free Writer's Voice podcast and newsletter at writersvoice.net.
Yahweh, 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 Yahoo, Yahweh, Yahweh, Yahoo, Yahweh, Yahoo.
That was the Tlingit National Anthem. To listen to a performance of traditional Tlingit music, find a link at writersvoice.net. And welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Go to writersvoice.net to listen again, like, and subscribe to the free podcast. And now let's get back to my conversation with Julian Brave Noisecat about his new book, We Survived the Night. Let's go on to the whole theme, I think, of not just resilience, but of renewal. You talk a lot about the disappropriation of Indian lands, of the resources, the salmon in the part of the book that is about coyote and the salmon, steals the salmon. You talk about how people have been moved off their lands repeatedly. And you connect displacement actually to renewal. So what does home mean when people are uprooted and then pushed to another area and uprooted again repeatedly? What anchors home for Indigenous peoples in this country?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think that home can mean multiple things. You know, on the one hand, as Indigenous peoples, the word Indigenous literally means to be rooted in the place that you come from. And that idea is also, you know, really deep within our own cultures and languages. In the Salish language family, for example, they've done so much linguistic analysis of our people that they have reconstructed a sort of proto-language that our ancestors spoke like over 6,000 years ago, back when all the Salish peoples would have been one people living in the sort of Fraser Valley near what is now Vancouver, and then spreading out from there, at least according to linguistic and cultural, anthropological, archaeological analysis. And in that proto-language, the word for people and land, people and place, is actually one and the same. It's like much, mich. And that is really interesting because it suggests that our understanding of what it is to be human and also what it is to be land is intertwined deeply, that there is something fundamental to our humanity about being from a place, and that also maybe there's something fundamental about being a place to having some claim to humans, that these two things are supposed to have a symbiotic interrelationship, you know, that we are maybe in fact nothing without our land, without our relationship to our place. And that is part of why it was so confusing to us when, you know, outsiders showed up from somewhere else that didn't look like us and were wandering. And that's also part of why the coyote is considered a trickster, because he's wandering. The fact that he doesn't move across the land in a way that, you know, maps the logic of, you know, providing for oneself and being connected to a place is part of what makes him a symbol of trouble being afoot in the narrative. But at the same time as all of that, you know, the reality of Indigenous peoples beginning, especially in the latter half of the 20th century, has been one wherein the majority of Native people in the United States and Canada now demographically are actually situated in cities, in urban areas. And in those urban areas, we have also found each other and created community. Really interestingly, it was urban Indigenous peoples, probably more so than Native people on reservations, who drove the resurgence of Indigenous culture and political activism beginning in the late 1960s and really picking up steam in the 1970s. You know, it was urban natives, for example, in the Bay Area where I grew up, who made the decision to occupy Alcatraz Island, a former federal prison, in 1969 in a protest that called attention to, you know, the plight of Native people and actually coincided with President Richard Nixon, of all people, shifting the United States' stated policy towards Native people from a goal of termination, that was literally the term, termination, to one of self-determination, which, you know, I check the news every day to see if it's still that. But to this day, that remains the paradigm. And this contemporary Indigenous resurgence, it's worth pointing out, has come from, at least in part, an era wherein Native people were sent to cities with the intention of them being assimilated, but wherein we actually instead found each other and created a new sense of identity, of culture, of pride, and of home.
And especially for you, because you're actually mixed race. Your mom is white, and she has a Jewish mother. Is that right?
Yep. So my mom is an Irish-Jewish New Yorker. And if you hear her talk, she really sounds the part. And it was actually my mom who kept me connected after my father left. She describes it as being instinctual in some sense. Her own sister tried to dissuade her from bringing me back to Canham Lake, for example, where my father's family is from. And yet my mom, every Christmas, essentially from the time that I was young, would drive us, usually she'd drive, from Oakland, California to Canham Lake, British Columbia, which is over 1,000 miles country away. It's over 24 hours in a car. She'd also, you know, bring me home many summers as well. She brought me down to the Intertribal Friendship House in Oakland, California, one of the oldest urban Indian community centers, one that was actually involved in planning that Alcatraz occupation that I just mentioned. She even learned how to bead so that I could have my own powwow regalia to dance. And to this day, she's actually still my first reader and editor. And so in all those ways and more, I really owe a lot of my native identity in certain ways, my connection to my culture and my family to my mom. I was actually in Canham Lake this summer for a fast pitch softball tournament for my late cousin brother. And when I was there, everybody was like, "Where's your mom? Where's your mom?" And I was like, "Am I not enough?" You know, because they consider her their sister, their auntie, because that is their conception of family and what it means to be related, which is a really beautiful thing, you know, that Indigenous peoples, many Indigenous peoples have this such an expansive view of who they can be related to, who their relatives are, and that really means a lot to us, you know, that we create connection and meaning with each other in that kind of a way, which I think is something that the rest of the world is struggling with right now because of the technology, because of the hyper-focus on the individual and the nuclear family over the last 60 years, because of, you know, our society's complicated relationship to notions of tradition and identity. You know, I think that in certain ways, Indigenous peoples have retained things that it turns out are really fundamental to our humanity that modern capitalist society has struggled to do.
Exactly. I mean, I think that's embodied in the phrase, all our relations. These stories, they're all about relationship. That's at the heart of it, rather than the alienation and individualism of the Western culture.
Yeah, and I think that implicit within all of that, or maybe not so implicit within all that, is a statement that directly contradicts the entire project of colonization, which said that our Indigenous ways were bad and backwards and therefore needed to die, and that when they died, it would be progress. I, in my work, whether it's We Survived the Night or Sugarcane or the work that I'm going to produce in the future, I'm saying the exact opposite of that. I'm saying that Indigenous peoples and our ways of life are good and beautiful and, you know, need to live because they show us good ways to live in relation to one another, in relation to the land, with a sense of cultural integrity and meaning that can, you know, provide insightful things about all kinds of different stuff, like, for example, how to relate better to the fish and the fisheries in such a way that, you know, we don't continue to just deplete these resources everywhere we go.
Yeah, and tell the story of red herring, because I think the contrast between the practices of the Indigenous people with the herring, which is a keystone species, as you explain in the book, I never knew that, is so completely different. Opposite, in fact, to the way it's practiced by industrial fishing.
Well, this was something that I learned actually when I was reporting the book. And in general, I find myself drawn to stories where I feel like I'm going to learn something about Indigenous people, Indigenous life across the continent, because there's a lot of books out there that do kind of like these books play a purpose. You know, I think it's important for people to understand Indigenous peoples in a basic kind of a way, and to figure out how to be good allies. Like I think a lot of literature that gets produced or published about Indigenous peoples is kind of in that vein. It's like some basic Indian 101 stuff. And then like, here's how you as a good liberal white person can relate to us in a better way and maybe not, you know, step on the many cultural rakes that are scattered about our very difficult history together. And that's good and important. And I'm glad those books exist, but that's not what I have set out to do in my work. You know, I am really drawn to stories where I get the opportunity to learn something new, because that is one of the beautiful things about, you know, telling stories, is that you get to go out into the world and learn stuff in nonfiction, and then through narrative, tell your readers what you've learned, because hopefully it'll help them understand something. And so I was in Alaska because the Alaska Natives are a powerful people in the United States, although they never get seen that way. They are 20% of the voters in a state that is an important swing state. They, you know, helped elect Lisa Murkowski in 2010 against a Tea Party rival. She's one of only two United States senators to ever win a write-in campaign for United States Senate. And it was because Alaska Natives backed her instead of the Democrat, even though they lean Democratic, Alaska Natives, because they were strategic and they saw that she'd be better than the Tea Party person. She had been adopted, or was adopted after that, by the Deshiton clan of the Tlingit. So she has a clan-based reciprocal relationship to an indigenous nation in that state. And they had to learn how to write in her name. So, you know, they were all teaching their cousins how to spell out Murkowski, which is maybe not the easiest thing to do. And so for all those reasons, I was always interested in Alaska. And while I was in Alaska for a writing retreat, I learned this story in Sitka, Alaska, which is like a really interesting enclave in Southeast Alaska. It's like a fishing town with a university and a hospital, which means that it has like a more cosmopolitan feel than maybe other parts of the state. And in Sitka, there's a big conflict ongoing between the Tlingit, the indigenous peoples of Sitka, and a commercial herring fishery over how the herring, and in particular their roe, the valuable eggs that they produce, are going to be fished and managed. And on one side of that, there is a commercial fishery that catches the herring and then largely discards the males, because they don't produce eggs, of course, although some of them are turned into fish feed, but it's largely a very wasteful fishery. And then they cut open the females and then take out the eggs, which are sold to the Japanese, where there's a significant market for what's called kazunoko, which is the herring sack roe, which the Japanese consume on New Year's. On the other side of this conflict are the Tlingit, who have been managing herring populations for something like 7,000 to 10,000 years. And they have when I learned it, I thought it was the most ingenious process I'd ever heard in my life for getting fish eggs. What they do is, instead of catching the fish, they create an artificial, not like artificial in like a plastic sense, but they create a man-made organic spawning habitat for the herring when they come in to spawn to lay their eggs on. They cut down young hemlock trees, is their preference, and then they submerge them in the shallows where the herring come and lay their eggs. And then that enables them to remove those trees after the spawn with the eggs on them, and then to consume those eggs, or even more brilliantly, to move those trees around to different bays and inlets in their region to encourage the herring in future generations to return to those bays and inlets. So it's a way for them to not only augment the spawning habitat for the herring and then to consume them in a sustainable, sort of a regenerative way, but also a way for them to like manage and increase the herring population. And so this Tlingit fishery, which is a subsistence fishery under Alaska law, is in deep conflict with the philosophy and also their description of what's going on to the fish, because they have very different views of the health of the fish population with the commercial herring industry. And so I was really drawn to this story as an example of something that, you know, really matters to indigenous peoples like my own on the West Coast, and in particular in the Northwest, which is our relationship to fish. And so the red herring chapter in it, I tell it in a tricksterly kind of way because I set it up through a story about my grandfather. And at the end of the chapter, I reveal something about that story about my grandfather, which then places me in a kind of funny position in the whole narrative allegory that I've just spun.
The good destruction of dams that are restoring salmon fishing in the Pacific Northwest. You know, what about the traditional principles of leadership can we take as we, you know, to try to restore what we have been so busily destroying?
Yeah, there's a lot of ways I could answer this question. I mean, firstly, I would say that in the book, there are profiles of two very prominent Indigenous women leaders who have made history. The first is Deb Haaland, the first ever Native American cabinet secretary, who was appointed interior secretary under President Biden. The other is Mary Simon, the first ever Indigenous governor general of Canada, which is the position appointed to represent the crown, the literal embodiment of the sovereign in the Canadian system. She's an Inuk woman, Inuit woman, who rose very interestingly through not some sort of crown or Canadian parliamentary tradition, but rather through the Inuit movement and that tradition, which is a prism through which I think I try to understand so much in this book is the traditions of the people whose story I'm telling as well as of my own people. And I do that very purposefully because, you know, I think very often in politics and in power, you know, we think about like the conservative tradition, the liberal tradition, the social democratic tradition, the socialist tradition. And I think that within my understanding of the field of political science and political history, there's little to no analysis that takes seriously the existence of something like the Inuit political tradition, the Tlingit political tradition, you know, the Pueblo political tradition, the Sequetmoc or Salish political tradition. And yet, if you look across Indian country and the very different ways that our people have related to colonization, which presented before us a lot of very consequential political decisions that we had to navigate very carefully in order to survive, you see, I would say, a set of different traditions that have surprisingly successfully navigated a lot of those junctures, so much so that, you know, the Inuit, you could make a really strong case, are second only to the nation states themselves in shaping the future of the Arctic. You know, this is not a insignificant people, which is another thing that I'm pushing back against, I think, across the book, is this notion that Indigenous peoples are so often viewed as inconsequential actors, when in fact, so much of North American history cannot be understood without the consequence of our actions, including and especially today in many places. And, you know, I think that very often, though not always, what Indigenous peoples are often advocating for is for the integrity of our way of life and intertwined with that, our land and water that enables that way of life. And I don't mean to say that all Indigenous peoples are environmentalists. I think that that sort of trope gets overplayed a bit in the sort of well-meaning left of center portrayal of events. I don't think that that's true at all. But in the story of coyotes stealing the salmon from these two witches and then leading them up the river, a story that we've talked a little bit about on this podcast, part of the basic message is that coyote is breaking a monopolist's trap that is catching and keeping all the fish for themselves. And part of the message in that environmental allegory is pretty simple. It's do not catch all the fish. You know, you need to share them with your own people, and you need to allow your upriver neighbors, even if you are bitter rivals with them, as we were sometimes, you know, to have their chance to get their fish to feed their people. And that essential principle, which was maintained, by the way, across thousands and thousands of years, enabled fish populations that used to be 100 million sockeye that would enter the Fraser River on a big run year. And that's not even according to Native people. That's according to the Department of Fisheries and Oceans Canada in one of their own papers. And it's important to point out that that's just one of five salmon species. today in a big year, it's more like, you know, the largest year on record since before the industries came is 20 million. So our people used to talk about a time when you could walk across the river bank to bank on the backs of salmon. And that picture might be a little bit more literal than metaphorical than the colonial narrative would have us believe.
Finally, you talk about the Arctic and the role of Native peoples in our history. The Arctic is changing because of climate change. There is a huge big power struggle that is going on over the Arctic that a lot of people are not aware of. And Trump wants to open up the National Arctic Wildlife Refuge. And you talk in the book, Julian Noisecat, in We Survive the Night, of the contradiction or the tension, the pressure to develop economically, to get the benefits of economic development under the capitalist mode, and also the pressures to maintain and keep the environment healthy. What do you see going forward, and what do you see about what you write about in the book as a guide to how these tensions can be navigated as we come to these new developments?
Well, you know, I think that part of what I describe in the book is a process of colonization that is very much alive right now. The notion that land dispossession, that conflicts over natural resources, over whose culture gets to govern these things, did not end in the 1800s, which is the way that they usually tell the story. It continues not only into the 20th century, but, you know, into our present. And I'm really curious to see how in this sort of rejiggering economic system, wherein Canada and the United States are disconnecting it to a certain extent as trading partners, you know, whether that drives a renewed era of natural resource production in Canada, which, you know, Canada has never fully escaped the natural resource trap. It is, to a certain extent, still a natural resource colony for the rest of the world. You know, it's a vast territory with significant supplies of timber and minerals and oil and gas and all these sorts of things. And that drive often brings it into tension with its first peoples. You know, similarly in the United States, there is a real shift happening in the Trump administration away from an attempt to, you know, turn the United States into a clean energy competitor to China. I think that that project, which was attempted under the Biden administration, seems to be a dream that is never really going to be fully pursued again, although I could be wrong about that. And I think that, you know, it'll be interesting to see whether a renewed emphasis on fossil fuel production, which, you know, brought us things like the movement against the Keystone XL pipeline, which had very prominent Native leadership, or even more prominently, the movement against the Dakota Access Pipeline, you know, at Standing Rock, which was probably the most significant Indigenous protest moment in United States history, maybe in global history. Whether those sort of things come back in this new era, which makes me a bit nervous sometimes because of the authoritarian direction our country is taking. You know, might it be that when we talk about, you know, colonization being a structure that exists to this day, you know, if you follow that to its logical conclusion about these conflicts, you know, that can lead to some very dark pictures of the future. And yet at the same time, I really mean it when I say that I believe Indigenous peoples remain consequential actors who have rarely been seen this way, but have actually been very clever in our dealings with the colonizers. I mean, that's part of how we're still here today. It's part of how we got Indigenous women in significant positions of leadership. And I don't see that tradition subsiding anytime soon either. And so I think that we are moving into a present that, and maybe this is what tradition tells us ultimately, will continue to have many echoes of the past.
Yes, and hopefully ever stronger. I think in many ways, the Indigenous values that you talk so much about in We Survive the Night are ones that are being increasingly adopted all over the world or readopted, because after all, they were the principles of all human beings for hundreds of thousands of years, or we would not have lasted as long as we have.
Yeah, I think that's definitely true. And more recent scholarship has made the case that some of the democratic, egalitarian turns in European political philosophy and thought might be attributed to the encounter of Europeans with indigenous peoples, particularly on the east coast of North America. And I tend to be pretty sympathetic to that view, and I continue to be hopeful that good human values will eventually find their market. Although I don't know, it seems to be not a high point in the market for good human values.
Well, we did have 7 million people at No King's Day, the last one, so
that's good.
Yeah. Well, it's been great to talk with you. This is a wonderful book.
Oh, thank you so much. This was a really lovely interview, Francesca. You did a really great job.
Well, best of luck on your book tour, and I'm going to go watch that documentary.
Awesome. I hope you enjoy it. And yeah, I hope we get to talk again someday soon.
Julian Brave Noisecat. Go to writersvoice.net for links to his article about his father, Ed Noisecat, as well as to his father's art. Every year for our Thanksgiving episode, we play our conversation with Native American storyteller and scholar Marge Bruschak about her people's story of how corn was given to them. We only have time today to play the song that accompanies the story, but you can go to writersvoice.net for a link to the entire story. Let's listen now.
And there's a song that goes along with that. It's called the Green Corn Song. And it's usually sung in four parts, thanking the four grandmothers that looked after that woman. And it kind of goes like this. Yanigawes, Yanigawes, Yahanigawes. Yanigawes, Yanigawes, Yahanigawes. Yanigawes, Yanigawes, Yahanigawes. Yanigawes, Yanigawes, Yahanigawes. Holalikikwehawanneo.
Marge Bruschak is an anthropologist, historian, and museum consultant. In addition to 1621, she's the author of other books, including the children's book, Malian Song. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Listen again for free, read book excerpts, and sign up for the podcast at writersvoice.net. I'm Francesca Rhiannon.